From claims of healings and visions to the world's most inexplicable events, whether you're a believer or a skeptic, the truth is always worth the hunt.
EWTN Radio presents The Miracle Hunter with Michael O'Neill.
Welcome to The Miracle Hunter Radio Show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm The Miracle Hunter. We had a big news story last week, and perhaps you saw this article that came out on the New York Times. There was a story about Sister Wilhelmina, the incorruptible nun from Missouri. They did an article, a long article with some beautiful photographs. They actually interviewed me for that article, and they squeezed in one quote from me, which was great. It was nice to see a secular outlet like the New York Times paying some attention to one of the big miracle stories from this past year. And so we'll keep our eyes on that Sister Wilhelmina cause for canonization. Maybe there'll be an episode of They Might Be Saints coming up in the future about her life and path towards sainthood. And speaking of They Might Be Saints, there's a brand new episode airing next week on Wednesday, September 20th at 8 a.m. Central Time, and that is about Venerable Mother Teresa Dujic. And I was excited to do this program especially. It's a future saint from Chicago, where I'm from, and despite the O apostrophe in my last name, I'm actually a Polish guy as well. So it's great to see a Polish nun from Chicago on the path to sainthood. So we were so excited. This may be our best episode yet, so check that one out. September 20th at 8 a.m. Central Time, and then it'll be in the lineup for They Might Be Saints on EWTN. And the story of Mother Teresa Dujic is an interesting one. It explores the life and ministry of Mother Teresa Dujic, a Polish immigrant who started the Chicago Franciscan Sisters against all odds. Without having the money, without having the resources, without having any backing, she launched this, and it's absolutely amazing to see this community arising in Chicago. So check that one out on September 20th at 8 a.m., the story of They Might Be Saints, Venerable Mother Teresa Dujic. And I was able to go there this past week to the Chicago Franciscan Sisters to present a preview of this episode. Very well received. What a wonderful community they have there with a great love for their foundress, Mother Teresa Dujic. So we'll be excited to have this air this next week on EWTN. And check out my other EWTN show, Explore with the Miracle Hunter. There's an episode on Borang, this Belgian apparition, and that airs on September 16th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. That's tonight. And you can explore one of the 20th century's most highly approved Marian apparition cases, as the Virgin with the Golden Heart appeared 33 times to five children in a convent school in Borang, Belgium. And I'll be reporting on what has become of those apparition claims. Check out my latest book, Science and the Miraculous, How the Catholic Church Investigates the Supernatural. It's out from Tan Books and available at EWTNRC.com. Later in the show, we're going to be looking at the 365 Days with Mary project like we always do. For today's date, September 16th, we've got Our Lady of the Flagstones, or Our Lady of Las Lajas in Potosi, Colombia in 1754. In my opinion, this is one of the most interesting titles of the Virgin Mary. And the might-be saint of the day is Blessed Louis Alamond from 1380 to 1450. He lived in France. And the question of the week: has the Vatican requirement of not giving credibility to the Medjugorje apparitions been lifted? I'll do my best to answer that question in just a little bit. Let's take a look at the miracle news. We do this every week, where we look at the miracles happening around the world and those things that relate to miracles. There was a story that was reported on Alitea about a miraculous healing at a Eucharistic adoration. And this is a story told in retrospect. We have Julia today is a happy and healthy woman. 7 years ago, she was very sick until a miraculous healing at Eucharistic adoration changed her life. She was raised in a devout Catholic family, and her parents helped her and her six siblings put Jesus first. They lived within walking distance of their parish in Chicago, so it was easy for go to church often. And my friends and I, quote, could meet for early morning mass before school, and once a perpetual Eucharistic adoration chapel was established, I could go over and say hi to Jesus whenever I wanted. So that's a quote from Julia. They also had a regular holy hour. And Julia's health was never great, but it got much worse in her teens. And after seeing many doctors and undergoing extensive testing, she was diagnosed with postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome, POTS, a nervous system disorder that affects heart rate and blood pressure. And when I stood and I sat upright for too long, the blood would drain from my head, causing me to pass out, she explained. And so she had a difficult life as a result of this. this POTS, or POTS, maybe it's pronounced, I'm not sure. But it was, she would always go to Holy Mass on Saturdays, and then she would spend time in Eucharistic adoration. And on April 1st, 2017, Julia went with her family to the Adoration Chapel for her regular Saturday Holy Hour, and she could not sit upright in the pew, so she lay on an exercise mat in the back of the chapel, and she described the incredible thing that happened to that day. I had prayed for healing before, but the answer was always a very clear not yet. This time, my prayer was different. It was April Fool's Day. Knowing Jesus had a sense of humor, I asked if he would grant me a dramatic healing as an April Fool's prank so I could confuse people with my sudden health. To my surprise, he agreed. And so this is quite a story, and she was completely cured of her POTS as a result, and she no longer needed her walker or her wheelchair as a result of this incredible healing that happened in Eucharistic adoration. So check that article out on Elatea for more information about this miraculous healing that was claimed at Eucharistic adoration. Let's take a look at Catholic Pub Trivia. We do this every week where we ask a trivia question and give out a prize to an emailer that writes in with the correct answer. And people who know me, my friends, know that I love trivia. They might find, you might find me in a bar doing pub trivia on some night, but this is Catholic Pub Trivia. And so each week we ask a trivia question, give out a prize, the Miracle Hunter image of the faces of Mary. And so last week we talked about the Battle of Vienna with Christopher Check from Catholic Answers. And the question was, what was the name of the famous battle on October 7th, 1571, from which we get the Marian devotion, Queen of Victory, and the feast day of Our Lady of the Rosary? And that answer, we had many, many people writing in with the correct answer. I suppose I should pick more difficult questions. But the answer was Battle of Lepanto, and that was written in Jacob Monson from North Dakota, wrote in with the fastest answer. We'll be sending him out the prize, the image of the faces of Mary. Now, for this week's question, we're talking today with Dan Cheely about St. Januarius, the patron saint of Naples. And Naples has over 50 patron saints. Name any one of the others. Again, we want any one of the other 50 patron saints of Naples who's not St. Januarius. And there are some names in there that you're going to recognize. So you might be able to just take a wild guess and send me an email. Send me an email to my website, miraclehunter.com. You can go on the page that way, or you can send one to questions@miraclehunter.com. We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to be talking to Terry Cajunette, the executive producer of Mother Teresa and Me, a film that focuses on the dark night of the soul of Mother Teresa. Stay with us for that.
Now, back to the Miracle Hunter on EWTN. Here's Michael O'Neill.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Miracle Hunter radio show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm the Miracle Hunter. In this program, we talk a lot about saints and future saints specifically, and those people moving along the path to sainthood. And it seems that when you talk about many of these causes around the United States and around the world, there always needs to be sort of an explanation how someone becomes a saint. This idea of advancing along from servant of God, venerable, blessed, and saint. All the research and all the miracles and all the things that go in there. Sometimes the decades or centuries that happens in between when a saint dies and their formal declaration by Rome. But there's someone who lived in this world recently who almost universally everybody said, that is a living saint. Nobody quite worried about the canonization process and how it would all work. Everybody knew that soon enough that she would be declared a saint within the Catholic Church. And of course, that person is Mother Teresa of Calcutta. We're so excited about a brand new film that's coming out. It's called Mother Teresa and Me. In October 5th, it'll be featured in 800 theaters nationwide, and you'll be able to check it out and Fathom Events through that website. You'll be able to find it. But we're so excited about this brand new film, shining the light on everybody's favorite saint, you might say, that person who, even while alive, everybody knew that they were destined for sainthood. That's Mother Teresa. And we welcome to the program today the executive producer of that new film, Terry Cajunette. Welcome to the program today, Terry.
Well, thank you, Michael, for having me on.
Well, it's exciting to talk to you today. I mean, this is a great new film that's coming out that people are going to be excited to watch. And of course, Mother Teresa, as I said, everybody saw her as the living saint while she was alive, and people seek her out as a great intercessor now. What inspired you to turn your attention to Mother Teresa at this time?
Well, the inspiration came really from the lady who plays Mother Teresa in the film, Jacqueline Fritchie-Corna, who was visiting India. And for the first time, I was confronted by this incredible poverty, and especially on of children on the street. And she was really shocked. And she thought, you know, that I have to do something. You know, as a human being, she felt compelled to do something. And then she was shortly thereafter in the production office of a movie producer in Bollywood, and there was a big painting of Mother Teresa. And she was looking at that painting and she said, that's it. That's what we have to do. We need to tell the story of Mother Teresa. We need to inspire people to follow her, to do small acts of kindness all over the world, and to, in that sense, create a better world. Because we need more of Mother Teresa and her spirit in our world. So that's what really got us, that was the inspiration to make this movie.
Absolutely. And for people who don't know, this movie focuses on a touching story of a pregnant woman's journey through her own spiritual crisis after being inspired by the story of Mother Teresa of Calcutta. The person's name is Kavitha. Tell us a little bit about how the story unfolds through the eyes and the testimony of Kavitha.
Yeah, we thought, you know, the fantastic director of this film, Kamal Musale, we thought, you know, if you're 30 years old today, you have no recollection of Mother Teresa. Mm-hmm. And she's just this kind of, great thing, but you don't know much. And it's kind of difficult maybe to relate to her. But we thought, you know, with a contemporary character, a young character, a young woman, the youth, and this film is really much for the young people, could basically follow her on her discovery of Mother Teresa and through her eyes discover her. And this young lady, Kavitha, as you said, you know, she found herself pregnant. She lives in London. She's of Indian descent. Her boyfriend abandoned her. And she's completely desperate, just as her parents want her to marry, you know, a young man of her caste. And so she flees to India to her old nanny, and the old nanny happens to work for the missionaries of charity. She was herself adopted by the sister, so she gets into contact with Mother Teresa, with her order, also with her writings, and she discovers that Mother Teresa had been herself abandoned, or felt abandoned by Jesus, and that she was suffering greatly, and she certainly feels a kinship with Mother Teresa, because she's just been abandoned, and she has this kind of same feelings that Mother experienced early on. And so she starts working at the home of the dying, taking care of a dying lady. She goes to the orphanage, and so by working with others, she kind of solves her own crisis. And so we see through this device that not only do we discover Mother Teresa through the eyes of Mother Teresa, but we also see the influence of Mother Teresa on this young woman, and in that sense also the legacy of Mother Teresa that is really alive today. You know, it's not just a historical figure in that sense.
Absolutely. We're talking today with Terry Cajanet, the executive producer of Mother Teresa and Me, a brand new film about the great saint from Calcutta. And you mentioned something in your last comment about the spiritual struggles that Mother Teresa has had over the years. We might call it a dark night of the soul, perhaps. And many people aren't familiar with Mother Teresa's struggle in this way. We all know about her charitable works and her standing up around the world and giving great testimony and bringing people closer to the faith. But many people are kind of surprised at this idea of Mother Teresa experiencing a dark night of the soul where she felt disconnected from God. Can you talk a little bit about Mother Teresa's experience in this way?
Well, yeah, you know, before, you know, Mother Teresa was a superhero, you know, until her death. We saw her perform all these acts of kindness, saving the people in the streets all over the world, and you're like just in awe, and but you can't relate to her. You say like, this is somebody, it's another dimension. And when, you know, she had written these letters to her confessor, and she asked them for them to be destroyed, and they didn't destroy them. And when her canonization process started, these letters were brought to the Pope at that time, John Paul II. And he immediately said that these letters, not only did they have to be preserved, but they needed to be published so that everybody could read them, because he said that would make her an even greater saint. Because the point is, you know, that when you see her suffering and how, which goes on for many, many, many years, but she keeps going. She's faithful to the mission. She's still longing for God and for Christ to come back to her or talk to her again. And to experience that, when you read this, what she writes, this very painful words, you see the human being behind the superhero. And you see, and when you see how she reacts, it makes her a great example, somebody you want to emulate, you know, and say, you know, when you're in your own crisis, don't let yourself go, don't be a victim, pick yourself up, you know. And she's an amazing example how she got up every day. Not only did she do the work, but she also inspired thousands of vocations, and she led her sisters always towards Jesus. And just by that example, although she was herself like in a turmoil, and that's, I think that's what makes her really heroic, in the sense of the heroic virtues that are needed for sainthood. But that's something that nobody saw, not even her own sisters she was working with daily.
Absolutely incredible. Most people don't know that story of Mother Teresa. And so this new film, Mother Teresa and Me, shed some light on that. We're talking today with Terry Cajunet about the new film, Mother Teresa and Me. It's out in theaters on October 5th, over 800 theaters nationwide. People can go to fathomevents.com for more information on that. And when we talk about this film and your hopes for what people might experience through this. We have this story of Kavita. We have the story of Mother Teresa and framing those together. And we're hoping that people are inspired, that people can overcome their own troubles by helping the burdens of others. Talk about when you made this film and you're getting that out there on October 5th. What is your hope for people who go to that theater and see this story?
Well, the first hope is really that they're inspired when they see by what Mother Teresa did, and they say, well, you know, she used to say, you know, when people come to Calcutta, she says, there's enough misery where you are, you know. She says, go home and love your family, was kind of the phrase. And take care of the misery around you. And she was also saying, you know, that the greatest poverty was even worse, was loneliness. And there are plenty of lonely people in the West and in the U.S., you know. Mm-hmm. And these small acts of kindness can be, you know, where you help somebody cross the street, you carry their groceries, or you go visit someone, you smile to someone on the street, you acknowledge their existence, you know, in their human dignity. So you don't have to do great things, you know, and that's actually what Mother Teresa was saying. You know, it's like small things are great in the eyes of God. So let's not wait to do the big thing, but just do the little things. And if everybody does it, or a few people, that makes a better world. So that's really our first hope. And so that a lot of people go see this movie, because all the revenues of the movie go back to the poorest of the poor in the spirit of Mother Teresa. So nobody's becoming rich by this film. And the other thing is, we hope that people, you know, are inspired by the spirit of Mother Teresa, by her toughness, you know, by her resilience of not giving up, And because, you know, we live in this kind of culture of victimhood today, you know, like everybody's a victim, and you say, well, my destiny, I'm a victim, so there's nothing I can do about it. And so you get stuck. And if people look at how Mother Teresa behaves herself and how Kavita, following her example, you know, pulls herself up, it's a great inspiration how you deal about situations of crisis.
Absolutely. And for you, Terry, the executive producer of this film, Mother Teresa and Me, what was your takeaway, or what did you learn after going through the process of creating this new film?
Well, it's really what I'm telling you. You know, what I'm most impressed by is this the spirit of Mother Teresa, toughness, to not let go, to keep striving, to keep longing, to keep looking for, and at the meantime, doing the work, not throwing it in the towel, and under the greatest duress. Because I didn't know either. You know, when we set out to make this movie at the beginning, we thought we would do the movie about Mother Teresa who helps the poor, but without knowing of the distress she is. When we discovered it, we thought, well, it makes her so much more human and relatable that we wanted also to emphasize that side of her, because, you know, the church makes saints so to inspire us so we can follow their example, and that's where we can really follow her. Before, you know, what, create an order of 5,000 nuns and help all the poor of the world, a bit tough act to follow, but now everybody can follow her, and through these small acts of kindness and through resilience and not letting oneself go, and trusting the Lord at the end. That's what's the most important, you know. Although she was in this doubt, she always trusted, you know, and said, this is his vision, this is his order, or it's not my work, it's his work. And she kept executing, although she felt abandoned. It was astounding.
Absolutely incredible. The name of the film is Mother Teresa and Me. It's released in theaters on October 5th, 800 theaters throughout the United States. People can go to fathomevents.com/events/mother-teresa-and-me to get there, or just go to fathomevents.com. You can do a search for there as well to find out what theaters in your area are showing this film. And I encourage people who love Mother Teresa and want to find out more about her journey in her life to check this one out, Mother Teresa and Me.
You know, this is a one-time event on October 5th, and we need people to go to the cinema. If they go to the cinema, they'll add showtimes, they'll add play dates. But people have to see that there is a hunger for this film. There's a hunger for Mother Teresa. So it's important not to wait for the day of the screenings to go to the cinema, but to pre-buy the tickets online so they see, oh my God, there's lots of people are interested in this film. There's a demand. So please, if you like this movie or the sound of it, please go today and bring your friends, family, etc. Thank you.
Wonderful. Well, thank you for that, Terry. And we're so grateful to you, Terry Cadjonet, for joining us on today's program and your work as the executive producer of this film, Mother Teresa and Me. Thanks so much for being with us on today's program.
Thank you so much, Michael, for having me. It was a great pleasure.
God bless. That was Terry Cadjonet, the executive producer of Mother Teresa and Me, out in theaters on October 5th, 800 theaters around the country. Buy your tickets ahead of time so the theaters know that there's great interest in Mother Teresa of Calcutta. You can go to fathomevents.com for more information on what theaters are showing this film. We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to try to answer the question of the week. Are the Medjugorje apparitions still not allowed to be said as authentic by pilgrimages that are going there? Stay with us for that answer.
Now, back to the Miracle Hunter on EWTN. Here's Michael O'Neill.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Miracle Hunter radio show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm the Miracle Hunter. I love getting your questions. People write in from around the world with questions about miracles happening in today's world and those that have happened centuries ago. And I love giving presentations. I just gave a presentation this past week, and it's always fun to present for about 45 minutes at a parish or a conference or a shrine, and the audience listens to me for 45 minutes and then asks their questions about miracles. Sometimes those Q&A sessions go for quite a while, but always some good questions that come up. But I also love the email questions, and I have a new email question for today, and it's kind of a hard one. It is, Dear Miracle Hunter, I found a CDF letter from 2014 saying parishes cannot give credibility to the Medjugorje apparitions. Then I found another one from 2019. What's the most recent info or link that we have about the current stance about giving about pilgrimages and credibility? There are parishes still going to Medjugorje. Doesn't that automatically say they recognize it as authentic? And which is honestly confusing. So thank you so much, Mary. Well, thanks, Mary, for your question. And it's a good one. Of course, this refers to Medjugorje, the alleged 1981 apparitions to six children in Bosnia-Herzegovina, which have persisted from that time in 1981 to this modern day. The apparitions still go on. Thousands and thousands of messages have gone on, and the Catholic Church has never ruled in an official way on the supernatural. The local bishop has ruled on the supernaturality of these claims, but then in 2010, the Ruini Commission was formed by the Vatican. An investigation was underway, and there's never been any credibility given to the apparitions from Rome, per se. The local bishop has come out against them. But what has happened is they've set up an apostolic administrator there in Medjugorje, welcoming pilgrims and taking care of the pastoral needs there. This establishment of a apostolic administrator does not, in fact, declare it to be supernatural, but pilgrimages there are officially allowed now. Previously, there was a sort of ban on pilgrimages or a restriction on pilgrimages that people could go privately and have their own private opinions about these things, but conferences, Medjugorje conferences, Medjugorje pilgrimages, where it gave credence or accepted these apparitions as truly authentic, those were banned. And since then, pilgrimages have been allowed. And yes, by virtue of sending pilgrims there, there is some sort of a tacit agreement with the thought that these are approved Mary, or these are legitimate Marian apparitions. So has there been a formal statement that has reversed that previous statement that said that conferences and pilgrimages to Medjugorje should not take the authenticity for granted? No, there has not been a formal statement out of Rome or even out of the United States on this. So, does it still remain in force? I would say not necessarily, because we do have pilgrimages that are officially organized by parishes now that are going there, and there is an apostolic administrator there as well. So it seems that people can hold whatever opinion they want about Medjugorje while the church is still making a decision on the supernaturality. When that will come out, we may never know. The church may wait a very long time and may just persist in allowing pilgrims to come without having a formal declaration about whether it's authentic or not. So thank you so much, Mary, for your great question. It's a complicated one, but that's how I understand it anyway. If you have a question for the Miracle Hunter, send me an email to questions@miraclehunter.com or go to my website, miraclehunter.com, and send me a message that way, and maybe I'll be answering your question on the air next week. Let's take a look at the 365 Days with Mary project. For today, September 16th, we've got Our Lady of the Flagstones from Potosi in Colombia in 1754. The story goes that in 1754, Maria Mueces de Quiñones, an Indian woman from the village of Potosi in Colombia, and her deaf-mute daughter, Rosa, were caught in a storm. They sought refuge in a canyon where Rosa exclaimed with her first words, "The Mestiza is calling me." She did not see the figures of a woman and child that the girl described and fearfully ran back with her daughter to Ipiales and told the townspeople. On her return, the woman saw an apparition of Our Lady and child, and some months later, Rosa died and was in return to life when her mother prayed again at the cave. The townspeople came to see this place, and there was a miraculous image burned into the rocks, and that Our Lady's imprint is in a stone slab near the bottom of a pit of the Andes Mountains. And that is Our Lady of the Flagstones, Nuestra Señora de las Lajas, from Potosí in Colombia in the year 1754. For more information on this fascinating devotion, or any of the hundreds of other Marian devotions from around the world, you can go to the website 365dayswithmary.com, where you can pick up the book or download the app 365 Days with Mary. Let's take a look at They Might Be Saints. Sainthood news. We talk about people on the path to sainthood. We talk about servants of God, venerable, blesseds, before they have all their miracles and they're officially declared saints by Rome. And there was big news, big sainthood news this past week, that there was a family that was beatified on a, quote, day of joy in Poland. And on this day of joy in Poland, the Catholic Church on Sunday, for the first time ever, beatified an entire family at once. Josef and Victoria Ulma and their seven children, who were martyred during World War II for sheltering two Jewish families from the Nazis. And there's a quote that says, "It would be misleading if the day of beatification of the Ulma family served only to bring back to memory the terror of the atrocities perpetrated by their executioners, on whom, by the way, the judgment of history already weighs heavily," said Cardinal Marcello Semeraro, the prefect for the Dicastery for the Causes of Saints, in his homily at a beatification mass attended by 30,000 people in the family's village of Markova in southeastern Poland. Instead, the cardinal said, "We want today to be a day of joy because the page of the gospel written on paper has become for us a lived reality, which shines brightly in the Christian witness of the Ulma couple and the martyrdom of the new blesseds." And so this was absolutely amazing. So Stanislava, age 7, Barbara, age 6, Vladislav, age 5, Franciszek, almost 4, Antoni, age 2, and Maria were all executed. And the seventh Ulma child to die was the couple's unnamed son, who was in the process of being born. The boy had been incorrectly described in some news reports as the first unborn child to be beatified, a key detail that the Vatican currently clarified. There was no time to baptize the child. What transpired instead was a baptism of blood. So in the reflections on Sunday, Cardinal Semeraro also made a point to honor the memory of the Ulma's Jewish friends, who were also killed that same day. And Poland's chief rabbi, Michael Skudrich, at the beatification mass for the family, gave a short address as well. And so that's the amazing sainthood news coming this week, where we have that family of nine new blesseds joining the canon of saints. And so later this week, or next week, I should say, for They Might Be Saints, we have a brand new episode of They Might Be Saints, which will be airing this week. This will be the first episode in a little while, on Wednesday, September 20th at 8 p.m. Eastern or Central Time. The brand new episode of They Might Be Saints, Venerable Mother Teresa Dujic from Chicago. And this program explores the life and the ministry of Mother Teresa Dujic, a Polish immigrant who started the Chicago Franciscan Sisters against all odds. So check that one out on Wednesday, September 20th at 8 a.m. That's the new episode of They Might Be Saints. And if we look at the Might Be Saint of the Day for today, we have Blessed Louis Allemand from France, who lived from 1380 to 1450. And he was born in 1380 in Arbont Castle in the Diocese of Belley. And he was born to French nobility. And he became a canon lawyer and the bishop of Marbon in France in 1418. He became an advisor, a courtier, a diplomat in service to Pope Martin V. He became the Archbishop of France in 1423. And he was an important member of the Council of Bale in 1436 that maintained the supremacy of general councils over the Pope and worked to form the decree of the Immaculate Conception of Our Lady. While he was there, he worked with victims of a plague outbreak. And politics aside, Allemand was known for his strong faith, personal piety, and his dedicated shepherding of his diocese. He died on September 16th, 1450, and was beatified in 1527 by Pope Clement VII, confirming his cultus. And so when he gets one more miracle, he will be declared a saint. But for now, he is Blessed Louis Allemand from France. And that's the Might Be Saint of the Day. And of course, check out theymightbesaints.com or my book, They Might Be Saints, which is available at ewtnrc.com. We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to be talking with Dan Cheely, church historian, about St. Januarius and his annually liquefying blood. Stay with us for that.
Now, back to the Miracle Hunter on EWTN. Here's Michael O'Neill.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Miracle Hunter Radio Show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm the Miracle Hunter. People ask me the question a lot. What are the greatest miracles that are happening in this world today? And, you know, we talk about the miracles and canonization causes and the occasional Eucharistic miracle that pops up or a Marian apparition. But there's one miracle that happens with extreme regularity, or at least the report of a miracle, and that comes out of Naples. Of course, go to Naples for the pizza, but stay for St. Januarius if he's there, if you're there on his feast day, September 19th. And so the story behind St. Januarius is an amazing one. He's one of the 50 patron saints of Naples, and their most favorite one because of the liquefying blood that is set to happen on an annual basis on his feast day. And I was there in 2018 to see that and filming with EWTN, and we produced a program on that. But it was absolutely amazing to see the local people, the local devotion, how excitedly they come each and every year to see this happening. Well, we're excited today to be joined by Dan Cheeley, church historian, to break it down for us. Tell us what exactly is happening with the liquefying blood of St. Januarius. Welcome back to the show today, Dan.
It's always good to be with you, Michael.
Yeah, thanks for chatting again about this topic. I think it's so fascinating to me. It's one of the stranger things we have in Catholicism, and maybe we don't even know what to make of it entirely, but it's absolutely amazing. Just take it back a little bit. Who was San Gennaro, St. Januarius? Who was the man that they celebrate each year?
Well, he actually was someone who left a really big impact on the people of his time. He was a bishop in the area. He was not the bishop of Naples. Okay, he was a bishop in the area of Naples or in southern Italy. And he literally stuck his neck out, okay, during the persecution of Diocletian when there were Christian prisoners in jail in Pozzuoli, okay, in Latin in the ancient times they called it Puteoli. Now it's Pozzuoli. He went and visited them and gave them comfort. And he was risking himself doing that because he came more than one time. And the guards sort of got wise. They said, hey, this guy is some kind of big shot. He's got to be one of them, too. He's giving them little things to eat. You know, he's probably some kind of priest or bishop or something. We ought to nab him. And so they did. They grabbed him finally one time when he was visiting his friends in jail. And they put him to the test. Okay, are you willing to sacrifice to the gods? And he said, absolutely not. There's only one God. And so they said, okay, well, you're in too. And he had a couple of what I would call sidekicks, okay, some deacons with him, and they all got thrown in the clink. And then later they decided to bring them out with the others and feed them to the lions in the arena in Naples. And a strange thing happened at the time. The beasts, and you know, by the way, this is sort of documented. This is not the only person this happened. The beasts decided not to eat them, okay? And the people were all wondering, why is this going on? I mean, these are supposed to be starving animals. They're not eating them. So they said, finish them off. So they came in, and they chopped his head off, and the other guys that were with him, the other martyrs that were with him. And it was a phenomenon even at the time. You know, there was, it kind of struck the people, this is, something strange is going on here. And some of the locals actually gathered up his blood in some vials. And those vials then are apparently now what we've got in the Cathedral of Naples. And those are the focus now of the periodic miracle of the liquefaction of this blood. Several times a year, particularly on his feast day, September 19th, this powdery substance, which is traced back without any break all the way back to 1497 and really before, when the blood was brought from Benevento all the way to Naples, where it stayed. The blood had been moved several times over the centuries because of invasions of barbarians and stuff like that. But eventually came back to Naples, and from the time that Columbus was sailing the ocean blue, we've got, you know, a record of the this strange liquefaction that takes place all the time. So it's been studied more than anything in the world.
Okay.
The Shroud of Turin it rivals the Shroud of Turin with the attention that's been given to it.
What kind of tests have they actually cracked open that ampule and tested the blood?
No, they haven't done that. Okay, but what they've observed it under all kinds of conditions. They've had cameras, they've had scientists, they've had light microscopy, going through it. And indeed, it is human blood. Okay, they can tell now with the tests and stuff that they have the difference between duck blood and human blood, through the running rays through it. And indeed, it is human blood. Why? There's all sorts of fanciful speculations as to what might be happening with it. But no one, even to this day, can really explain it. It's been on Ripley's Believe It or Not. It's been on the History Channel. It's been on, well, it's obviously been on EWTN. Right. And they just can't figure things out. Now, they don't touch it. It's in a seal. It's in two sealed vials. But the blood will liquefy by itself, just to kind of show that this is real. I'm here. Okay, this is not just a joke. There have been a couple of times, seven times in the last 500 years, when they did some kind of, when they were trying to tighten up or do some work on the case that it's involved, it's placed in. And when they've done that, every once in a blue moon, all of a sudden, the blood will liquefy again. I mean, just to show, hey, this is not just dust you're dealing with. There's a saint's presence who is being manifested here. So
Now, Dan, let's talk about the elephant in the room, maybe. The blood liquefies every year, except when it doesn't. What happens when it doesn't?
They panic in Naples, when it doesn't. Okay, because they regard this, when the blood doesn't liquefy, as some sort of warning, as some message from the state. Bad. Not only strange things are happening, but bad things are about to happen. The most dramatic time was back about 40 years ago, when the blood did not liquefy, and sure enough, they had a gigantic earthquake that a few weeks later that really tortured that region. Hundreds of people were killed, and so I've been there too during the times of once I was there during the liquefaction, and the town is overjoyed when it does liquefy, because then they know, I guess we're okay for, for the next year or so, at least, or the next few months.
It's important to have a good year ahead. Exactly. Yeah,
it's reported on the news. People turn their TVs on and the radio's on. It's reported on the news each year, whether it liquefies or not. And of course, it's another excuse to celebrate in the region of Naples. They enjoy that. They bring out the pizza, the Italian ice, and the wine, and it's a great thing.
Yeah, I think when I was there, the shout that the crowd gives out, and it's a big crowd. The cathedral or basilica is completely packed, and the streets are packed. And then on the screens, they have this, and then when it liquefies, it's like a game-winning touchdown of a football game. Everybody erupts in a big cheer, and we couldn't even get in that close with our cameras for EWTN. So we came back at 7 p.m. to film, and it was still packed, and people were still partying in the streets. So it's a big deal there in Naples.
Well, it's a whole elaborate thing that they do, okay? This is not something that was reported happening in 700 A.D., and, who knows if the records are valid or not. I mean, there's a chain of custody, going back certainly to 1497 when it was brought into Naples, and before that, I mean, we know where the vials were from the 400s on. Okay, and they bring out a bust, a statue of the top part of St. Januarius with a bishop's mitre on, and inside that bust, that metal bust, is the skull of St. Januarius. And what the ritual is, they bring the vials out of the safe, and they put them next to the head. And you wait. Okay, people are praying, and then finally when it varies in time how long it will take to liquefy. But they, when it does, of course, the bishop or cardinal will say, the miracle has occurred, and then they ring the bells, and they have a procession. You know, they march from one, with the vials, with the head from one church to another, and they, then it's there for people to see for about 7 days. It stays liquid for about 7 days and then returns to kind of dust.
Yeah, and I think it's a little bit different every year, isn't it? The time when it happens, how long it stays liquefied, and there's not a temperature. There's not a temperature difference. There's not a shaking of the vial. So it's very interesting.
No shaking. And again, this is if this is some kind of conspiracy, something would have come out by now. Okay, since 1497, people have been watching this. I mean, the great the father of modern church history, the venerable Caesar Baronius, studied it in the 1500s. Okay, he called it an ongoing miracle then. And, everybody scratched their heads. He said, this is just something that can't be explained. And, now it's been studied with more modern techniques. And the communists and rationalists and, have suggested there's got to be some kind of fraud here, but nobody can find it. Nobody can find where the fraud is occurring. And they do it. I mean, they keep it in the safe. It's under observation. Nobody knows how this happens. So it's a very interesting thing. What I think about it is because he is somebody who stuck his neck out and they gathered his blood, I think what God is telling us through this thing that, this blood that's been shed in his name is not dead. This guy, they thought they finished him off. The lions and tigers wouldn't eat him, so they chopped his head off. But guess what? He's still alive. Okay, and anything done for Christ is goes into eternity. You enter into an entirely different dimension. And guess what, guys? We're going to show you this right now so that you know that death is not the end. There's more to life than what meets the eye.
Yeah, it's absolutely incredible. I recommend people going to see this. This is an absolutely amazing thing. And of course, the church has not declared in a formal way that this is a miracle, like they do with Marian apparitions or Eucharistic miracles or the miracles for the saints. This is not something that's been investigated or formally declared by Rome, but people like Pope Francis have gone, and the blood is liquefied in his presence. So there's some show of church support for it, but perhaps not the full investigative process that we're used to with other miracles. So we're so grateful to you, Dan Cheeley, a church historian, for joining us again to talk about St. Januarius. This is one of everybody's favorite miracles that happens every single year.
Call anytime.
And that's all the time we have for today's show. If you missed any of this episode or want to catch up on past episodes, you can go to ewtn.com/radio, check out the audio archives, or download the free EWTN app. I'd like to thank our guest today, Dan Cheeley, talking to us about St. Januarius, and Terry Cajanet about his movie Mother Teresa and Me in theaters next month. Tonight, on September 16th, at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we have Explore with the Miracle Hunter, the Boerang episode, one of the 20th century's most highly approved Marian apparition cases. The Virgin with the Golden Heart appeared 33 times to five children at a convent school in Boerang in Belgium. And next week, Wednesday, September 20th at 8 a.m., we've got a brand new episode of They Might Be Saints, Venerable Mother Teresa Dujic from Chicago. Check out my latest book, Science and the Miraculous, How the Catholic Church Investigates the Supernatural, out from Tan Books and available at ewtnrc.com. I'd like to thank you, too, for joining me today on Miracle Hunter, where from claims of healings and visions to the world's most inexplicable events, whether you're a believer or a skeptic, the truth is always worth the hunt. Talk to you next week.